Good evening. The pandemic rears its head in the South. Trump praises American workers for building warships used to crush a nation of children and the biggest financial company you never heard of. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, June 26th, 2020. As confirmed coronavirus infections surged to an all-time high of 40,000 per day in the United States Friday, Texas and Florida slammed their reopening into reverse. It's the nation's biggest retreat yet as the disease continues its grim march. Texas Governor Greg Abbott ordered all bars closed, while Florida banned alcohol sales at public watering holes, joining a growing list of states that are putting off any further reopening. A large number of cases are among young people who are going out again, often without wearing masks or observing social distancing rules. The White House Coronavirus Task Force held its first meeting in over 2 months without Trump. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who emerged as a trusted voice, says the pandemic is changing with the times.
When you have an outbreak of an infectious disease, it's a dynamic process that is global. So remember, what happened in China affected us. What happened in Europe affected us. What's happening here is affecting others. We can't get away from that. It's interconnected. So therefore, if we are an interconnected society, we've got to look at the fact of what our role is in trying to put an end to this. Because everybody wants to end it. Everybody wants to get back to normal. And everybody wants the economy to recover. I think we all are pretty common in that. That's a given. So what can we do? What I think upon talking to a lot of people and reflecting on it, we have such an unusual situation because of all of the decades that I've been involved in chasing infectious diseases. I've never seen anything that is so protean in its ability to make people sick or not. There's no other infectious disease that goes from 40% of the people having no symptoms to some having mild symptoms, to some having severe, some requiring staying at home for weeks, some going to the hospital, some getting intensive care, some getting intubated, some getting ventilated, and some dying. So that depending on where you are in that spectrum, you have a different attitude to this particular thing. But anyone who gets infected or is at risk of getting infected, to a greater or less degree, is part of the dynamic process of the outbreak. And I know because I can understand when I was at a stage in my life when I said, well, I'm invulnerable, so I'm going to take a risk. I think what we're missing in this is something that we've never faced before, is that a risk for you is not just isolated to you. Because if you get infected, you are part, innocently or inadvertently, of propagating the dynamic process of a pandemic. Because the chances are that if you get infected, that you're going to infect someone else. And although you may feel well, and because we know, if you look at the numbers that you'll probably hear later on, the overwhelming majority now of people getting infected are young people, likely the people that you see in the clips and in the paper who are out in crowds enjoying themselves, understandably. No blame there, understandably. But the thing that you really need to realize that when you do that, you are part of a process. So if you get infected, you will infect someone else who clearly will infect someone else. We know that happens because the reproduction element of the virus is not less than one. So people are infecting other people. And then ultimately, you will infect someone who's vulnerable. Now, that may be somebody's grandmother, grandfather, uncle who's on chemotherapy, aunt who's on radiation or chemotherapy, or a child who has leukemia.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Protean means ability to change quickly. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi doubled down on her allegations that Trump is guilty of murder.
The administration, in terms of their denial, their delay on the coronavirus, caused death. Add that to your bill of particulars. Policy has an impact, and we can prevent future deaths if we ban the chokeholds. I'm fully committed to that. Yes, ma'am.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, U.S. deaths are currently at 600 per day, down from 2,200 per day in April. Vice President Mike Pence continued his defense of the Trump administration's handling of the crisis. Pence claims a decline in deaths despite an increase in cases of the disease is a sign that he says the country is in a much better place.
What we're seeing across the South today is really outbreaks. They're outbreaks that are in specific counties. In some cases, there are outbreaks that are in specific communities, and we've surged CDC personnel, HHS personnel. I didn't mention before, but 3 weeks ago when we were seeing similar activity in North Carolina and Alabama, we sent personnel into those states, and we've actually seen declining numbers beginning in both of those states. So the important thing is that not one size fits all. The overall guidance to every American to practice good hygiene, to practice the measures that we recommended at home and at work, stand. But our focus today is to make sure that in those areas of the country where we're seeing a significant, not only increase in cases, but an increase in positivity level, that the American people know just how important it is to listen to what their state and local health officials are directing them to do. In some cases, there's statewide guidance with regard to facial coverings and with regard to events and gatherings. In other cases, there are specific countywide or citywide directives. And we just believe that what's most important here is that people listen to the leadership in their state, the leadership in their local community, and adhere to that guidance, whether that have to do with facial coverings, whether it have to do with the size of gatherings, and we'll continue to reinforce that message.
What is the correlation between the spike in cases that we're seeing in states like Texas and Florida and the way those states handled their reopening? Was it too much too soon?
What we're observing today, and I've heard this from Florida, I've heard this from Texas, and some other states along the Sun Belt, is that we're seeing more and more young people under the age of 35 who are testing positive. In many cases, they have no symptoms. And if there's one message that comes through today, I hope it is saying to younger Americans in these states and in these counties in particular that they are a big part of the numbers that we are seeing in new cases, urging them to take countermeasures and heed what their governors and local officials are directing will be our continued strategy.
The virus is blamed for 124,000 deaths in the United States and 2.4 million confirmed infections nationwide. Meanwhile, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said Friday his state is reaching out to officials in Arizona, Texas, and Florida to offer help with equipment or personnel to deal with the crisis. The governor said the gesture was intended to return a favor from states such as California, Washington, and Oregon, whose officials sent New York ventilators in April when nearly 1,000 people a day were dying in the state. New York experienced 951 hospitalizations yesterday, the lowest number since the start of the crisis. Addressing the increase of cases in some Sun Belt states, Cuomo said there is now irrefutable evidence rushed reopenings were a mistake. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Yesterday, President Trump spoke in Marinette, Wisconsin at the Fincantieri Marinette Marine Shipyard, where the Navy is building 10 guided missile frigates, a $5.5 billion contract. Unlike his disastrous speech in Tulsa last week, the public was not invited. Instead, Trump addressed the shipyard workers in a region of Wisconsin he carried heavily 4 years ago. Wisconsin is a swing state essential to Trump if he's to win re-election in November.
It's going to be built right here in the American heartland, and it's going to be built by you. And it's going to go on for a long time because it's up to 20 ships that it might be extended. And they're working on an extension right now. And we'll see. But just go. You're going to be building your hearts away. So good luck on the program. The massive deal is worth up to $5.5 billion. We'll put the shipyard to work constructing some of the fastest, most advanced, and most maneuverable combat ships anywhere in the ocean. I hear the maneuverability is one of the big factors that you were chosen for the contract. The other is your location in Wisconsin, if you want to know the truth. This contract will support your 1,500 full-time employees, and it will also enable you to hire another 1,000 people all across the shipyards in Wisconsin. It's one of the biggest contracts you've ever seen in the state. An estimated 15,000 additional new jobs will be created through the Wisconsin supply chain. You notice that's not a supply chain going through China and going through other countries. It's called the Wisconsin. Isn't that nice? The Wisconsin supply chain. That's been bugging me for about 25 years. I think that's why I became president. You want to know the truth?
President Trump in Marinette, Wisconsin yesterday. The high-tech ships are designed for near-shore combat. Four of the 10 ships being built in Wisconsin are destined for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been embroiled in a conflict with neighboring Yemen. Yemen has suffered in the brutal war. Saudi Arabia and its allies, supported by the United States, have been blockading the nation. According to the United Nations, starvation and an unchecked plague of COVID-19 have left Yemen hanging by a thread. The co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence is Kathy Kelly.
At that shipyard now being built are four what they call littoral combat ships, which are not for sale to the United States Navy ultimately, but rather the U.S. Navy has agreed to sell them to Saudi Arabia. Those ships are being used to blockade Yemen. And Yemen, I mean, the way they... UN humanitarian coordinator put it just on Wednesday of this week, that it's about to fall off the cliff. It's so desperate while still being just bludgeoned by the Saudis through airstrikes and a terrible blockade. The other shipyard that was trying so hard to get this contract, and that's the Bath Iron Works shipyard in Maine, and the very, very interesting situation of those workers having gone out on strike 2 days ago. Should the United States industries be constantly at the service of building instruments of death, basically, really, we could turn the whole world into a bloody battleground by our weapon making.
Something to do with why the president made that sort of pointed remark targeting the domestic enemies of Maine, or is that just a typical Trumpism?
Well, I think he was trying to get votes in Wisconsin and make them think, well, the president did a good thing for us. We ought to do a good thing for him and reelect him because these policies of supporting the Marinette shipyard and all the infrastructure that keeps Marinette going are good for our state. And I think if he had thought that he wanted to carry Maine as a state that would be most important for him, we might have seen that the Bath Iron Works would have gotten that contract.
Has the U.S. done anything to help Yemen because of the COVID epidemic that's striking their country?
Precisely at the time when people are in acute need for survival, the United States cut back what would be previously expected to go to Yemen in terms of aid that would come through the United States AID. And it also made cutbacks to the World Health Organization, which have been so severe that people in the United Nations organizations are saying, we're going to run out of funding in a matter of weeks. So I think, you know, it makes the whole country more dependent on wherever they can get aid. And, of course, the terrible reality is that the Saudis are kind of holding them hostage and saying, well, we could provide aid, but we're not going to do it unless we've got people in place who will basically function as puppets to go along with our demands. And the United States keeps on supporting the Saudis. Certainly the Trump administration is threatening to completely eliminate congressional oversight over weapons sales. And weapons like these littoral combat ships comprise just one component. Every single week there are shiploads of weapons departing from the United States ports, bringing to the Saudis more and more material to blow people up, destroy homes, wreck infrastructure.
Does this have to do with Trump's obsession with fighting Iran?
Well, I suppose so. I think it also, though, has to do with very powerful corporations like Raytheon and Boeing and General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin profiting enormously if they can sell these weapons that they make to the Saudis. They're disinterested in the consequences of these sales. And, of course, they have tremendous power over congressional representatives and senators and Trump.
Last question, your advice to the voters of Wisconsin.
So I think they should speak up. It's interesting that right now a lot of their Democratic representatives are saying, oh, no, no, Trump didn't arrange that sale, we did. And I think they should confront all of their representatives and say, look, these weapon sales and weapon developments are outmoded. It doesn't suit the world we're in today, and they should demand that Wisconsin representatives start paying attention integrally related issues of pandemic, the racial disparities, and climate control, an issue which is greatly affecting people of color more so than any other groups in the United States.
Kathy Kelly is co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. According to UNICEF, 2.4 million Yemeni children could be malnourished, and 10 million children do not have sufficient access to safe water, sanitation, or hygiene. In related news, as a strike by thousands of workers at Bath Iron Works entered its third day, company and union officials on Wednesday exchanged letters about potentially restarting negotiations, but instead became only further entrenched. Members of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers Local S6 voted to strike Sunday after the union rejected a three-year contract offer from shipyard owner General Dynamics. And the stock market continued a week-long slide on the news that the coronavirus pandemic has reemerged with a vengeance in the United States. Next month, the CARES Act stimulus package passed by Congress will run out, ending extended unemployment insurance for millions. But rich and powerful financial institutions apparently have little to worry about. But a little-known financial behemoth, BlackRock, with over $7 trillion in assets and control of another $20 trillion, is making out well. Its strategic importance has made the company too big to fail. The founder of the Public Banking Institute is Ellen Brown. She says BlackRock is taking advantage of bailouts to bail out itself.
BlackRock is huge, but like you, most people have never heard of it. It's an asset manager, so it manages investments largely for pension funds and big entities, but it also its big thing right now are exchange-traded funds, and so a lot of individuals have exchange-traded funds. You know, it's something you can actually buy on the stock market. It's a fund of many corporate bonds. There are three huge exchange-traded funds that dominate the market, and BlackRock is the biggest of those. It's probably the largest financial entity in the world. It manages over $7 trillion in assets that allow the Federal Reserve to buy things that it otherwise can't buy. It's supposed to only buy bonds that are or debt that is government guaranteed. So it typically buys treasury bills, bonds and notes, or mortgage-backed securities, federally backed loans. So BlackRock has put in charge of determining what assets the Federal Reserve can fund. It can't do it directly, legally. It's not allowed to buy all these dodgy corporate assets. The excuse is that we need to bail out these corporations because of the virus. But if you look closely, who got bailed out was BlackRock itself.
Why is this a bad thing?
Because all the big money is going to the big corporations. And the Federal Reserve, through these vehicles, we, the taxpayers, have put up $454 billion to capitalize these 11 special purpose vehicles that will be managed by BlackRock. And that will allow the Federal Reserve to create up to $4.5 trillion in credit just created on its books. It's the financialized economy versus the real economy. So you have all this credit just being created on the books of the deep pocket of the Federal Reserve, our central bank, which can just create money as it will. And we, the little people, are lucky to, well, state and local governments, for example, have to borrow, paying 3% or 4% or 5% interest, whereas the banks themselves can borrow for free. The big financialized institutions are getting all this virtually free credit and getting bailed out, whereas the small businesses are getting nothing. All your little mom and pop stores, restaurants, etc., that had to lay people off, they can't even take advantage of that. What BlackRock did, the only thing it had bought as of May 30th was exchange-traded funds, 50% of which were owned by BlackRock itself. So what it really did was bail itself out because the exchange-traded funds were in trouble.
2008 Redux, is this the same thing?
Yes, it's the same thing they did after 2008, but it's worse in this case. And they're using the virus as an excuse. But the banks were already in trouble last September. All the big financial institutions were borrowing at the repo market, and it was in trouble. And so the Fed stepped in and bailed it out, and then they stepped in and bailed the banks out in March, and now they've bailed out BlackRock, which is the world's largest entity.
What's your alternative to all this?
At the very least, BlackRock needs to be regulated. It's really a shadow bank. It's a bank. It does things like banks do, and it should be one of those too big to fail systemically important financial institutions that got regulated under the Dodd-Frank Act. But better yet, what it really should be is nationalized, or at least turned into a public utility made to serve the public interest, because it's the public that is propping it up and all these big financial entities.
Ellen Brown is founder of the Public Banking Institute. Closer to home, Mayor de Blasio considered a question on the minds of millions of students and parents in the city. Will school reopen in September?
I can't tell you what's going to happen in 2 months. I can tell you plan A is the maximum number of kids in schools. We're going to also keep a distance learning capacity because some parents won't be ready yet. And if the disease situation gets better, more and more kids in schools, God forbid it gets worse, more and more kids on distance learning. But we are right now retrofitting the schools so they will be ready to handle the maximum number of kids in person September 10th. We're looking at all the options because we're dealing with a huge amount of unknown and something that's over 2 months away. But I think the simplest way to think about it is that the most educators want to come back, most parents want their kids to come back. We're planning on that assumption. Of course we have to have options. Not only different levels of remote learning depending on the disease, but we have to have options where there are schools, for example, a school that was overcrowded back in February, by definition, cannot put 6 feet between kids, so they can only handle a certain amount of their kids at a given time. So we're working out schedules to work for those schools. Some other schools are not overcrowded. They can do it more easily. We're taking gym space, auditorium space, whatever it takes to use as classroom space. Look, we're still in a crisis. We're on a crisis footing. So we're going to use every available space, set up for the maximum number of kids, be ready for staggering where it's needed. I don't think there's so much talk about weekend, but we're going to look at, of course, anything and everything as we get closer. On the budget ramifications, can't speak to that yet. That's still being looked at. What we do know is it's constant dialogue with the folks involved and surveying of parents to hear what they want, so employees and parents. And we're going to get there. We're going to get there. We're going to make it work. We'll adjust according to health dynamics. And one day there's going to be a vaccine. And I think that's the day when you're going to see things go back 100% to every kid in the classroom as normal.
Mayor de Blasio. And as New York City begins the arduous process of reopening, issues important to local communities are returning in force. WBAI's Jillian Jonas asked de Blasio if the reopening, done with little regulatory oversight of quality of life issues, would be a nightmare for residents trying to get a night's sleep or negotiate packed sidewalks. She also asked de Blasio if his advisory councils are leaning too hard on the same old elites and missing a chance to bring new voices to the table.
I heard from communities plenty about before the pandemic, about noise, about crowds. These are real issues. This is part of why we started a nightlife office. And what I found was our nightlife office actually made a real big impact. Not perfect by any stretch, but made a big impact working with bar owners, nightclub owners, restaurant owners, working with a bunch of agencies, working with communities to try and strike the right balance. And Ariel Palitz and her team there, I think, have really done extraordinary work. And they'll be right in the middle of addressing these issues now. But I think the self-certification was absolutely the right thing to do in this context. Jillian, you're right. Self-certification as a broad concept over recent years, different parts of government, there's some real issues there. And you have to be really careful when you allow it. In the middle of a pandemic, when restaurants are trying to survive and we're trying to revive the economy, give people back their jobs, absolutely the right thing to do. When I was up at Melba's restaurant in Harlem and she said she could do the form in 5 minutes and get her restaurant back up and bring people back to work, that was music to my ears. But we will have civilian agencies out there educating
making sure people can move, that there's not too much crowding, addressing noise issues. We don't want to do fines and other enforcement in the first instance if we can solve the problem. But if we have to, of course, we reserve that right.
Many of people have pointed to your own advisory councils, the appointees, as a lot of permanent government types, especially the Real Estate and Construction Council. There are no, I believe, new kinds of stakeholders like preservationists, independent planners, or affordable housing advocates who aren't also developers. Isn't this the perfect opportunity to kind of shake things up?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair point, Jillian. And I'm going to ask my colleagues who are working on this, like Deputy Mayor Vicky Bean, to take that point to heart and see if we need to add people. Look, I think the immediate issue, we have different groups we put together here. The advisory councils, of course, are part of the long term, but really the first thing we said at the time, the first thing with those sector advisory councils was getting back up and running and figuring out the restart. And I think the people on those advisory councils were well chosen for that purpose. But I think you make a great point. If we have to think beyond the immediate restart to the recovery and changing the status quo, are there voices we need to bring in who are not yet present? Very fair point. So we're going to look at that and see how we can improve upon that. The other entities, which are working intensely on the process of change, the internal task force on racial inclusion and equity, obviously, is a great example. We've announced there's going to be a commission on racial justice and reconciliation. These entities are obviously focusing on immediate change and long-term change. So there's more than one venue playing out here, to say the least. But I think your point's well taken, and we'll work to add other folks to those advisory councils.
Mayor de Blasio. And that's some of the news for Friday, June 26, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jillian Jonas. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.